If you would, go ahead and turn your Bibles to Psalm chapter 1. Let's go ahead and read the first few words of Psalms 1, verse 1. And then I want to stop there for a second. It says, "Blessed is the man," and I want to stop right there. If you were to consider the usage of the term blessed in the Old Testament, you would find that the meaning of the word is based not only on the underlying Hebrew definition, but it's also based on the context in which the word blessed is used. For example, if you were to look at Psalms 28, verse 6, the Bible says, "Blessed be the Lord, because he has heard my supplication." In that instance, the underlying Hebrew word is used as an expression of praise. It's interesting to note that the same Hebrew word is used where God pronounces his blessings on man. In Genesis 24, verse 1, it says, "Now Abraham is old, well advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things." And so the same word is used in both instances, but varies based on context. And so you get the concept there that the word blessed, if you look it up in the Bible, it's a word that overlays multiple meanings. In Psalms 1, where you read there, "Blessed is the man," the underlying Hebrew word actually means "how happy" or "happiness." This evening, I'd like to look at Psalms 1, where David provides characteristics of a man that he describes as being blessed or truly happy. I'd like to start by reading the entire passage, and then I'd like to examine the psalm verse by verse. And by doing this, I'd like to see if we can have a good Bible study and find things in the psalm that we can apply to our lives. I think oftentimes the best way to learn how to live as a New Testament Christian is to examine principles that we find in the Old Testament. Look at Psalms 1, and I want to read it the way it's translated, with the underlying Hebrew meaning there. "Blessed," or "how happy, is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish." Let's start by examining the first verse of the psalm. We see that David starts out by identifying a blessed man by what he doesn't do. You see there it says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly." So we find that a blessed man doesn't seek the counsel of wicked men. But I'd like to consider some other passages in the Bible that tells us how God would have us to seek counsel. In Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 15, I'm sorry I don't have a PowerPoint. If you'd like to follow along, you can place your marker in Psalms 1 and turn your pages of the Bible. But in Proverbs 12 verse 15, it says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise." So not only are we to receive godly counsel, but Solomon says that a wise man does indeed seek counsel. It also says that the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. If you look in Proverbs 20, verse 5, it says, "Counsel in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." So we find that when we do seek counsel, sometimes you have to fish around for it. You have to draw for it like water in a deep well. A wise individual exerts effort in seeking the counsel that the wise have to offer. But I'd like to consider example of this. You turn to 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12, and I'd like to read verses 1 through 14. Starting in verse 1 there, it says, "And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt, that they had sent and called him. Then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you.' So he said to them, 'Depart for me, depart for 3 days, then come back to me.' And the people departed. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived, and he said, 'How do you advise me to answer these people?' And they spoke to him, saying, 'If you will be a servant to these people today, and serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him, and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. And he said to them, "What advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me? Lighten the yoke which your father has put on us." Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. And now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges.'" So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king had directed, saying, "Come back to me the third day." And the king answered the people roughly, and rejected the advice which the elders had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges." My aunt once told me one time, she said, "Stephen, when you're choosing friends," she said, "if you want to soar with the eagles, don't hang out with turkeys." But this is kind of what Rehoboam had done. He had rejected the advice of the elders and instead taken the advice of his peers. And we can go on to read in this passage that Rehoboam's decision had caused his people to turn away from him. And his decision initiated the divided kingdom, which was prophesied beforehand to occur in Israel. And oftentimes, when seeking counsel, the counsel of ungodly people can sound appealing and reasonable. And we hear it all the time in the world. For example, you know, the world always says, do what's best for you. Do what you feel is right. And, you know, you need to live together before marriage. It's you need to test things out before you make that big commitment. And, you know, people in college might say, you don't need to go to church tonight. You already go three times a week. And before I got married, one individual I worked with approached me and said, you know, before you get married, be sure to have a good bachelor party. It's your last chance to do that before you get tied down. And I said, well, no, I'm a Christian. I don't do stuff like that. But he was so persistent. You know, he said, you know, you really need to do that. It surprised me that he really thought he was offering me good advice. So we see that the world is ready and willing to offer all types of advice on many different subjects. And that advice is oftentimes appealing to our flesh. But the Bible says it's a blessed man that stands not in the counsel of the ungodly. Look at verse 2 of Psalms 1. Another characteristic of the blessed man is that he does not stand in the path of sinners. I'd like to examine that for a bit. And considering this for a minute, I'd like to consider what the Bible states about the different paths we can choose to walk as people of God. And we'll start with a well-known passage. If you go to Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. The Bible reads, "Enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way that leads to life, and there are few who find it." So we see that the gate that leads to destruction is broad and easy to enter. It's the road more frequently traveled. And it's fair to say it's the road more frequently traveled by those that willingly lead lives separate from God, that willingly leave lives of sin. I'd also like to read a passage that really describes the path that sinners walk. If you go to Proverbs chapter 2, Proverbs chapter 2, and starting there in verse 10. The Bible reads, "When wisdom enters your heart and knowledge is pleasant to your soul, discretion will preserve you, understanding will keep you, to deliver you from the way of evil, from the man who speaks perverse things, from those who leave the path of uprightness to walk in the paths of darkness." But what does the path of darkness look like? Well, we find out in verse 14. "Who rejoice in doing evil and delight in the perversity of the wicked, whose ways are crooked and who are devious in their paths, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. For her house leads down to death and her paths to the dead. None who go to her return, nor do they regain the paths of life. So you may walk in the way of goodness and keep the paths of righteousness. For the upright will dwell in the land, and the blameless will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the earth, and the unfaithful will be uprooted from it." So Solomon says that wise individuals know better than to walk on paths that involve evil, perverse things, and sexual immorality. And we see that these paths lead to death, where David says a man's blessed if he doesn't even stand on that path. Yet as Christians, sometimes we can make ourselves finding provisions to get there. If you go, I like this passage, Romans chapter 13, Romans 13, verses 13 and 14, which says, Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. And so as Christians, we must recognize that we're not blessed if we sin willingly or make excuse or provision to do so. We must not find ourselves standing on the paths that sinners walk. And when I use the word sinner, I'm talking about people who willingly lead lives separate from God. In the latter part of verse 1 in Psalms 1, we also find that a blessed man doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful. In today's world, we see that, you know, people like to scoff and make fun of people all the time. If you just walk down the street, you can hear people doing this left and right. And it's so common that we can find ourselves doing it if we're not careful. I mean, I'm guilty of this every time I drive in my car, I think, because everybody else doesn't seem to really know what they're doing. So I'm kind of making fun of them and doing things I shouldn't do. But we find in the Bible that our speech is to be separate and apart from that of the world. In Colossians 4, verses 5 through 6, it says, "Walk in wisdom towards those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." And another passage in Titus further confirms this. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 8, it says, "Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded, in all things showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you." It's interesting, if you go back to Psalms 1 and you think of the wording of the verse, it says, "Sit in the seat of scoffers." Have you ever known someone that's like a people watcher, that kind of just sits down and makes fun of other people? And, you know, people just kind of look at other people sometimes and go, "Look how that guy walks, man, doesn't he look funny?" Or say, "Look what he's wearing, he doesn't look that good today, he looks stupid," you know? And they'll just kind of make fun of other people all the time. And brethren, that's the speech of the world. And we must be careful that we don't adopt that. We find that the Bible teaches us to be humble and that our speech is to be seasoned with salt, separate and apart from that of the world. I know I spent about 15 minutes on verse 1. Don't worry, the rest of the psalm goes by a little bit faster than that. But if you take a step back, and I just want to get a conceptual look at Psalms 1. You take a step back and you look at Psalms 1 and verse 1, you see that this is a person that really just doesn't find himself doing evil things. He doesn't find himself doing the things that people of the world do. He just doesn't even dabble in those things. You know, when I was growing up, there was a person that went to church with me. I was in high school and he was in high school. And this individual would come to church and he'd lead the most beautiful prayers. And he'd say, you know, wonderful invitations. And he'd know all the right things to say to you. You'd say hi and he'd say hi and he'd be very nice and polite. And come to find out that out in the world, he just wasn't that person. You know, he would go to parties, he'd drink, he'd get involved with drugs, and we found out that he just wasn't the guy that he showed himself to be. And when you're thinking of that, this person in Psalms 1 is an offense rider. He really just loves the law of God. He abhors what is evil. He doesn't find himself in those situations. But and David goes on to say this in verse 2, and I'd like to read verses 2 and 3 here. It says, "But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does, he shall prosper." In verse 2, we see that we need to meditate on God's law day and night. And we find that this was a common attitude with David. And we can find throughout the Psalms that he had an attitude such as this. Example is Psalms 119. Verses 21 through 24, where David says, "You rebuke the proud, the cursed, who stray from your commandments. Remove from me reproach and contempt, for I have kept your testimonies. Princes also sit and speak against me, but your servant meditates on your statutes. Your testimonies are mighty light, and are my counselors." We need to find godly things to meditate on. In Philippians 5 and verse 8, the Bible reads, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue in anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." And this can also be accomplished by praying continually. 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. So my question is, what kind of things do you meditate on? What kind of things do you watch? What kind of things do you read? These things influence our thinking. The psalmist says that a man's blessed if he meditates on God's law day and night. I'd like to read verse 3 again. He says, he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. You know, you never have to worry about a tree that's planted by a river because it's always getting watered. It's always getting the nutrients and nourishment it needs to live and thrive. We know that a tree in that situation is always going to live and always bear fruit. You can be in a desert and there can be a river going through a desert. And if you have a tree by a riverbank, that tree can be there for hundreds of years. And yet, you can throw a stone's throw out from the tree and you can be a sagebrush for as far as the eye can see. But trees just thrive near the water. But this is how God describes a man who is blessed. They are always meditating on God's law. They're meditating on it day and night. They're receiving constant nourishment from that. And they're going to continue to live and thrive and bear fruit. I think that's what that analogy speaks about. A passage in Galatians also speaks to the fruit we bear if we've been sacrificed with Christ. It says, Galatians 5, verses 22 through 26. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be conceited, provoking one another, envying one another. So if truly living as New Testament Christians, we'll love God's law and we'll bear fruit. Let's go back to Psalms 1, read verses 4 and 5. It says, the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. In the Old Testament, we know that God would judge Israel if he disregarded his law. The land would not bear fruit for them, and God would allow them to be conquered by their enemies. And we know that God holds the wicked accountable for their deeds. Jesus taught this exact thing when he lived on the earth, that wicked man will not stand in the day of judgment. An example of that is Matthew chapter 13, verses 36 through 43. The Bible reads there, then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house, and his disciples came to him, saying, explain to us the parable of the tares in the field. He answered and said to them, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is of the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. But we find as we live in the world, it can be hard to practice the things that God would have us to do. But we also see that we're rewarded for doing those things according to our deeds. In the judgment, the righteous will stand. And finally, in verse 6, it says, For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. The word here for know in the Hebrew actually means to see or observe. And it can literally be translated that the Lord sees or observes the way of the righteous. And this is particular comfort to me because I know that the Lord is seeing every action that I do, both good and evil. And I know that he rewards those in the end that choose to serve him. In conclusion, we know that the world claims to have many avenues to happiness. And these are obvious all around us. You know, their money, fame, a new house. They'll say a relationship makes you happy. Your position in life, a raise, finding your soulmate. And the list goes on and on. However, we see that true happiness is derived from loving God, loving his law, walking according to his will, and abhorring what is evil. Only then can we truly take part in all the blessings that God has to offer his people. And what great blessings God has to offer us. I'm gonna close tonight with a familiar passage in John 3:16. I'm gonna read verses 16 and 17. It says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved." So in conclusion, I ask you, have you been happy, have you been made happy in the way that matters? Not in the way that the world offers, but a happiness that comes from being cleansed of sin and having a relationship with the Father. If you have any needs tonight, feel free to make them known at this time as together we stand and sing.